My name is Sanjeev Gupta, and this is Socialism in the Time of Corona. In this podcast, I'm talking with people with deep experience in socialist and left politics, especially in the US. Our overarching question is, during this pandemic, how might we not only defend whatever gains we've made to this point, but actually advance them? It's probably fanciful to describe the ongoing struggle against white supremacy generally, and the police in particular, as the Third American War of Independence, the second being the Civil War. For one, only one side has and has used the equipment and techniques of organized violence. But perhaps you'll indulge me the hyperbole, given that an estimated 20 million people in the US have been on the streets for more than 30 days nonstop, with new protest sites appearing on the map every day, and drawing in people energized by a broad range of issues in addition to the immediate ones. And given that, if you take at face value the declaration of the First American War of Independence, as I, like many immigrants to the US, do, that all people have the God-given rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, well, let's just say that wars have been fought over much less than the demands of the current protests. In this episode, I talk with Robert Cuffey, one of the organizers of this movement in New York City, confronting one of the most powerful police departments, not only in the US, but the world. Cuffey is a member of the organizing committee of the New York City Afro-Socialist Caucus of the Democratic Socialists of America, DSA, a member of the organizing committee of the New York City Labor Branch, and a longtime rank-and-file member of Social Services Employees Union Local 371. He also happens to be the co-founder of the Socialist Workers Alliance in Guyana. And most directly relevant to our conversation here, he's an organizer with the People's Strike Network, which is the New York City organization of the Fight for Our Lives Coalition. Our conversation ranged widely over time, space, and political strategy, from China to the Caribbean, the 19th century to the present, and across debates among socialists about class and race. I've divided it into two pieces that are more or less self-contained, though best absorbed together. In this first part, we discuss the current protests in their broader historical context, including the question of why now? Why have the most recent police executions made it possible for demands like abolition and defunding to burst into the country's political consciousness? Cuffey began by describing the links between the pandemic and policing in New York City, even before the protests began.
In New York City, one of the things that was happening under COVID-19 was a special issue of police brutality, right? Because they were using the cops to enforce social distancing. And it was disproportionately against people of color and Black people, especially. Like, I remember at one point, the statistics were 41 arrests for social distancing violations, and 35 of the people arrested were Black. Oh, and a lot of it got caught on camera. And like, one of the most notorious incidents happened on May 2nd, right? Like, the day after our protest, it was this officer from the police service area number 4 on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. And the police service areas, for those who don't know, in New York City, they exclusively patrol public housing. So this officer was caught on tape, like, roughing up two people as he arrested them in social distancing. But even more than that, Officer Francisco Garcia then turns on the guy filming him, Donnie Wright, and wrestles him to the ground and pretty much sits on his head in a not dissimilar way from the way Officer Chauvin in Minneapolis, like, kneeled on George Floyd's neck. So we had this going on, and we had to decide, well, what are we going to plan our June protests about? And, like, it was a natural impetus because another incident, and I don't know the young lady's name, but there's a video of a young lady, she's about maybe 19, 20 years old, entering the subway with a toddler, like a little kid walking next to her. And she's wearing a mask, but it's pulled down under her chin, and she's just tackled by 6 police officers. Right. So like images like this convince us like this is what we had to do. But then in the lead up to June 1st, we find out more and more about like old cases. We find out about Breonna Taylor and the no-knock warrant and how she was executed on the spot. We find out about the vigilante lynching of Ahmaud Arbery, which had, you know, happened earlier in the year, but the guys were still running free. And then George Floyd was murdered, and that poured fuel on the fire that no one can expect. So for our June 1st event, which we thought might be a few hundred people, it turns into thousands of people, right? Like, we don't even have enough marshals necessary to control this and how it's going. But thankfully, there's this marshals associated with the Democratic Socialists of America in New York City called the Red Rabbits. And on pretty late notice, they turned out and helped us with things. But like, it was an amazing protest in that it foregrounded the members of the community on the Lower East Side from public housing. They were primarily the ones to speak. You know, we even had an elder from the community sing us a song to get us in the mood. And she reminded people, like, leave the community the way you found it, right? So then this march, we didn't plan a route, right? We were marching from the corner where the incident happened with Donnie Wright and Francisco Garcia, Officer Garcia. And then we're going to go to the precinct, which was like 3 blocks away. This protest ended up going all the way downtown to one police plaza and then hit the FDR highway. And the miraculous thing was that no one was arrested. But it was also a turning point in New York City, because that Monday was, if I remember correctly, the first night of the curfew, right? That Monday, June 1st. And at that time, the curfew was set for 11. So we made sure everyone dissipated by 10:30, that everyone got home, they checked in, and everyone was safe. But then the heat got turned up in New York City, because people rightfully said, we have a First Amendment right to be in the streets. You're not going to silence these protests. And really, this curfew was just by another name what Mayor de Blasio and Police Commissioner Shea had tried before, which is they said, there's now a ban on protests. No protest. And the reality is they had no constitutional power to do so, and they found out pretty quickly, so they reneged on that. But then came this curfew, right, which is something being used in other parts of the country where there are rebellions, and other parts of the world where, like, COVID-19 is a reality. So the movement where people see, like, police cars being blown up and these types of things kind of, like, intensifies under the curfew. So my fear that Friday, the Barclays 2 Fridays ago, was that maybe the moment was gone. But I can tell you that this weekend, there were so many protests that I have them blurred in my head. Like, I was riding my bicycle to protest and arriving late because I got blocked off by other protests, you know, that I just didn't know about. And I think this last weekend was a great impetus as well, because it was Juneteenth weekend.
Yeah.
Right. And it's Juneteenth has so much significance in both, like, celebration of Black life and culture, and the actual history that people in Galveston, Texas, didn't find out until 2 years after the Emancipation Proclamation that they were free is a very apt tale of what Black life in America has been and has always meant. You know, that the freedom that exists for everyone else has long been denied to us. And the only thing you can do at the end of the day is to fight for that freedom. And oftentimes that fight gets encapsulated in these urban rebellions, right? Like, urban rebellions going as far back as the 60s and 70s with Watts, or you fast forward to Los Angeles in 92, or Cincinnati in 2001, Ferguson and Baltimore at the start of the Black Lives Matter uprising. And today we're here again, and it's, the significance, at least to me, is that we're in a moment where this rebellion has brought in a larger layer of the population. It's helped to shift consciousness to the point that people are more willing to believe now that Black people have negative experiences with the police just because they're Black. And it's created a global movement, right? So like through this work, I've connected with a comrade named Juliana, who's from Brazil, but they live here in the United States. But they were able to make parallels to me about the police killing of this 14-year-old named João Pedro in Brazil, and how the Black Lives Matter movement here that started with justice for George Floyd helped to drive that struggle forward back home, and it helped to like cohere the Black liberation movement there as well.
Yeah, not to mention London and Paris, you know.
Yeah, London, Paris, different parts of Western Africa, South Africa, Jamaica, you know. Mm. I can even say, like, from my personal experience, as a Guyanese, I don't recall if there were any protests. And part of it is I don't necessarily have my ear to the ground because of so much that's happening. But one thing that happened is that the government of Guyana, the sitting government, which is on the precipice of losing power, tried to use George Floyd's murder to their advantage to say, and they wrote this in the government newspaper, "We stand in solidarity with Brother Floyd, you know, we're against this anti-Black racism that's pervading in the United States." But then they tried to turn it around and say that we, as a mostly Afro-Guyanese government, are also suffering the same fate, which is why we're being kicked out of power, when the real issue is that democratically they lost the vote, but because the country is about to start reaping the wealth from oil exploration through Exxon, they want to remain in power to scoop off the top. So it's like, you know, that's like a parallel with the Democrats and the Kente Klot Stoles kneeling to appease the movement.
Mm, yeah. You know, there's plenty of that kind of opportunism to go around. And so, you know, you mentioned all these other protests on really essentially or a bunch of them being the same issues of police brutality over the last many years. And so the, you know, I guess I should ask you the question that we're all asking each other is why do you think this is different? I mean, what is qualitatively, what has changed to, you know, have this one be the thing that's catching fire?
Well, you know, as a Marxist, my understanding of the capitalist world is that it's one prone to crisis. And while I'm not a crisis monger, I think it's important to like really dig deep into the political economy of it. And part of it has to do with the fact that capitalism is set up in such a way that it prioritizes profit over people, right? Like that's a generally understood concept. But that capitalism suffers from a crisis of profits, that it cannot maintain the same standards for the working class or even itself, and it's a self-degrading system of accumulation of capital, is not something that's popularly understood. And then within this long-term crisis of capitalism, there are these cyclical crises, right, that people are more familiar with, the boom and bust cycles. Mm-hmm. And I think it's very telling when the busts keep happening and the booms don't happen. So like in the United States, it was a post-world boom, right? Like the United States emerged victorious and the most unaffected from World War II. And there was this period of growth up until around the 70s. And people have this historical mindset that this golden days of America is the standard, right? That you could reach that. So part of what happened when Hillary Clinton lost, for example, is that there was a real material change happening in people's lives, that people's life expectancy was being lowered. Like even the white working class was suffering through like an opioid crisis. And however bad this was for the working class generally, for Black people, it was even more catastrophic. So if we could then pivot to two of the most recent crises, you see how intricately linked they are with Black life. And you think about the Great Recession started by the subprime mortgage crisis, right? The subprime mortgage crisis was a way to sell houses to Black people who could not afford them. We had people actively forging documents on behalf of Black homeowners. Mm-hmm. And then, not only that, because we're in an interconnected international capitalist system, then these mortgages were bundled together and sold overseas so that when the Black homeowners could no longer afford to pay, it brought down the international market. But who was bailed out? The bankers were bailed out. No bankers went to jail. And black wealth was decimated as a result, because under American capitalism, wealth is primarily stored in property. So with that decimation, you see that, black life takes a tumble. And in addition to that, we continue to see, even under a black president at the time, these indiscriminate murders of young black men and women. And one of the things that had changed then, I believe, that brought about the first Black Lives Matter movement was the advent of social media, right? Like Black Lives Matter came from a tweet by Alicia Garza. That's where the slogan comes from. But part of it is that social media has put a magnifying glass on these incidents, and that they cannot sweep it under the rug any longer, right? Like, they tried to do this with Ahmaud Arbery, for example. Ahmaud Arbery was murdered in February. We started protesting about it months later. Why? Because investigative journalists, people who are more citizen journalists, people who can easily empower themselves with a GoPro and a MacBook, they went out and did the work, and then they spread it across social media networks. So in that situation, it was like, you know, Marx uses a phrase that capitalism creates its own gravediggers. And even capitalism's technological developments in that way armed working class, poor and oppressed people to shine a light of transparency that the capitalist class did not want to see. So the Black Lives Matter movement in many ways got ate up by the electoral campaign against Trump. And Obama and Clinton told people back then, you know, you can't just be screaming in the streets all the time. You need policy proposals. And up came the policy proposals. We had the citizen proposals. We had the Movement for Black Lives. We had, and we still have these. And we have the Black Youth Project 100, the agenda to fund Black futures. But there seemed to be a delinking of building a mass movement to enforce the government to win these demands. And it kind of seems as if we went into like more of a nonprofit type space or a lobbying effort, right? But nonetheless, these organizations remained, like Black Lives Matter New York, for example, did great work in the interim, for example, to get the officer, Daniel Pantaleo, who murdered Eric Garner, fired, right? Yeah. Like they, but it wasn't a mass movement anymore, you know, like streets were not burning. But if you fast forward then to the beginning of 2020, what we have is this COVID-19 crisis. And I can tell you, in New York City, like the most popular topic of conversation before COVID broke out was the fact that the city had finally banned plastic bags at the supermarkets and stores, and that you'd have to be using reusable, because it was like a major lifestyle adjustment. And when the COVID-19 epidemic broke out, not only did the stores go back to using plastic bags, and they were given permission to do so, but no one talked about it anymore, because people were literally in a fight for their lives. Because in New York City, we've had upward of 17,000 people die from COVID-19, much of it preventable because the government was, and the mayor, the governor, were dragging their feet on necessary measures. It took bottom-up organizing for like the teachers within the United Federation of Teachers Union. They had to take action to threaten to shut down the schools to get the schools closed, because the schools were a vector for transmission. So we had all of these things happening. I was like, I have this comrade, Vanessa Wills, and she recently pointed out that what is different about this period is that not just that we have another crisis, we have several crises going on. We have a public health crisis. We have an economic crisis. We have an unemployment crisis. And then to, on top of all that, we have a crisis of policing, right? And the police, for the most part, have experienced legitimacy in American society. For example, like if you go to court and you say, you know, that officer is lying, the judge will take the officer's word against you, because the judge is going to say, oh, no, this person is employed by the state. They wouldn't risk their career by this. You know, like, but we're in a moment where this legitimacy is being questioned. And even if it's being questioned in a symbolic way, it is of the craziest importance. And to me, that's what's different this time. It's like the fire we're seeing this time is fueled by several pieces of ignition that have not come together before. But also part of it, at least to me, is like literally capitalism creating its own grave diggers. Because if this virus did originate in China, and this is not to suggest Trump's racist Chinese virus nonsense. Right. If it did originate in China, then we have to talk about what world capitalism has done to China, how it has transformed the Chinese rural population partly into a migrant hoku system where people in port cities suffer such terrible conditions that they live in dormitories with suicide nets, right? Because they're there producing the goods for capital at a super exploitative rate that the Western European and other international financiers cannot afford if they were to do it within like what's now the Rust Belt or something like that, because the workers here have a higher level of organization and struggle and unions to say, you know, we want to extract a higher wage. And to think that, they, you know, China is here propping up the world economy based on the fact that it's allowed the world to super exploit part of its population. And around these same areas and in this country, which is also, you know, locking down Uyghur migrants and these types of things, develops a public health crisis that spreads across the world. That's literally what Malcolm X would call the chickens coming home to roost.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and not to mention, I mean, you know, just travel. I mean, people and, you know, New York City being sort of, you know, the city where people come and go from. I mean, still, you know, with, So if I understand correctly, what we're saying here is that there's this convergence of, you know, a major economic crisis, obviously a public health crisis. And so then on top of that, George Floyd is one straw too many. In some ways, the question is academic because, you know, I don't know, in 10 or 15 or 20 years, you know, we look back and maybe have a better idea of, you know, what exactly happened. So I guess the reason, you know, to try to figure this out now is if it actually sort of, you know, helps us strategize in the moment, you know, and you sort of try to pick, okay, so if I think it's because of, you know, X, then I should be doing this. But if I think it's mostly about this, I should be doing Y. And so that's one motivation for, you know, I'm sort of basically quizzing everyone I'm talking to because it's, you know, it's like, how do we make use of this? Maybe it doesn't really matter. I mean, you know, we do what we're doing day to day. And
I mean, I would say part of it has to be that we have to study history, right? Because there's no need to reinvent the wheel when people have tried to do what we're doing already.
Yeah.
And we want to avoid the pitfalls, right? We want to avoid the missteps, and we want to build on the strengths of the prior movement. So like, as much as I enjoy organizing, there's definitely got to be room made for political education and theorizing. So like, for example, I think one person who understood the strength, the character of the Black struggle in the United States better than most is the Trinidadian revolutionary C.L.R. James. Mm-hmm. And he had lived in the United States for about 10 years when he wrote this document called The Revolutionary Answer to the Negro Question. And I'll say the significance of that document, but I think the significance of his experience kind of gives some scaffolding for where the document comes from. This is a Black Trinidadian author, a very good writer of literature and history, who gets recruited to the Marxist movement. He moves to the United Kingdom, and from the United Kingdom, he's recruited to the Trotskyist movement, and he comes to the United States to live. And one of the things people don't fully understand about Black people from the Caribbean is that while we experience racism, yes, we do, there are a few parts of the Caribbean where there's an actual white working class population, right? So we don't actually experience white people. And as we experience them, we kind of experience them on TV and novels and advertisements and these types of things. Part of it then means that we kind of have an easier relationship with white radicals, right? Because we can't say that any of these white radicals in our city, their ancestors might have been part of this pogrom or anything like that. Mm-hmm. But so James has this convivial relationship with the white radicals, but also he, at one point before Leon Trotsky is assassinated, goes to Mexico to meet with Trotsky, to talk with Trotsky about the parallels of the Black struggle and the struggle of Jews for self-determination. And James has to travel through the South to do this. And for the first time, he experiences what Jim Crow racism is like, right? Where he can't sit in the same spaces as white people. And it's like a very jarring experience. So like over the next decade, James tries to ground himself as an intellectual. Like everyone who met him said he was a very learned man, and that's the errors he gave off. But James actually went to the South, sat down with sharecroppers, and he would write their stories out for them and publish it at pamphlets, right? Like he would try populist things like doing a socialist version of FDR's fireside chats. He would have like a, my friend, a fireside chat on the war when World War II broke out. But so James had this outward facing stuff happening. And then within the organization, he was battling against the leader of the organization, Max Shackman, and this black guy, Ernest Rice McKinney, who kind of put forward like a class first perspective, right? They said labor had to take the lead. And over the years, James and his compatriots in the Johnson Forest tendency, who were chiefly Raya Dunayevskaya and Grace Lee Boggs, came up with this analysis arguing about the primacy of the Black struggle. So in 1948, when James writes the revolutionary answer to the Negro question, it's a distillation of his experiences, but also an intense study of Black history that he'd conducted. Because one of the things James noticed is one of the things Trotsky noticed about American socialists, which is they don't know American history. They know Russian history very well. But like, you know, there's yet to be like the authoritative Marxist history, for example, of the United States. It's like, you know, the, one second, there's the People's History of the United States by Howard Zinn, which is very radical, but not explicitly Marxist. And that's then there's right. the more obscure Hofstadter text and so on. So like James combines this distillation of history, and that's a phrase I'm stealing from another friend. My friends are good though. It's like there's this distillation of history as theory. There are his personal experiences, and then there's his experiences of this ideological iron sharpness, iron polemics against Max Shackman and others within the Workers' Party, that by the time he quits the Workers' Party and goes into the Socialist Workers' Party for a brief period, he writes this document for their convention that says, and I'm finally here, I'm sorry, I know I'm like an erupting volcano, it takes forever to get to the point.
That's okay.
He writes this document that says that the Black struggle has a dynamic of its own that not just pushes it forward to fight for basic rights for itself, but pushes it forward in such a way that it could lead the entire working class in struggle. Mm-hmm. And I think when we talked before about these crises combining, right, the crises combined and fell heaviest on Black people. And as a result, Black people had less time for the bullshit. Black people had less time to wring their hands and say, oh, what should we do? And Black people acted. So like people talk about outside agitators, right, when they say that the protests have become violent. But the first night of protests I went to at the Barclays Center, what I saw was an organic rage from young Black men like myself who've had negative experiences with the police and have finally gotten an outlet for it, right? Like, and in New York City, this was bubbling to the surface, because I don't know if you know, in New York City, there were like a few months before COVID hit scandals. What were the scandals? The scandals were that people in the housing projects would go up on the roof and pour water on the police as they walk by. Mm. But if you've ever been to public housing in New York City, in addition to me saying, you know, they have their own distinct precincts, there's almost always a cop car parked somewhere there, oftentimes with their lights flashing. not because there's an emergency, but because Black life is pretty much treated as like an occupation. Mm. So I'm at this protest at the Barclays, and I'm telling you, like, the young Black people are taunting the cops to do something to them. They're the ones rushing the barricades, right? They're not harming the cops, but they're doing things like throwing themselves on the ground and putting their hands behind their backs and saying, arrest me. Mm. So, like, people need to understand that there's, like, a burgeoning rage, and that's what has been unleashed now, and it's what's unleashed during every rebellion against police terror. And it could never be a riot, because riots don't make demands, right? And we've seen so many political demands raised in this. Like, here in New York, where our Fight for Our Lives contingent started, our main demand was cancel the rent. And that's still going on, even though housing courts reopened today, and they're going to pretty soon start the eviction process. But we got something for them, too. Mm. But, when we have rallies, no one is focused exclusively on Black Lives Mattering in regard to police brutality. We're uplifting the struggle of, like, Black trans people, Black queer people, Black teachers, Black educators. And it's pretty much linked to this crisis I talked about before, because in the past, when these struggles have erupted, when they've threatened the social stability of capitalism, when they've threatened the ability for them to keep society orderly and create profits, the movements were in some ways meaningfully bought off. In the 60s and 70s, we got legislation like the Voting Rights Act, the Civil Rights Act, right? And in the 70s, when things really got heated in Watts and Harlem and the different places, we got access as Black people to public sector jobs in phenomenal numbers, to the point that the majority of postal workers are people of color, the majority of transit workers are people of color, and so on and so forth. Capitalism is now in such a stage that instead of opening access to a new level of employment or being able to grant a material improvement in the lives of Black people, it has to rely on symbolism. But more importantly, things are so bad that in the budgets we see coming down, there's cuts to the public sector. So this is another way in which capitalism is forcing this crisis to land disproportionately, not just on the backs of the working class, on which it always balances its budgets, but specifically on the backs of Black people. So the cuts to the postal service are being threatened. And if Trump has his way, the postal service will be privatized. Cuts to transit here in New York City and all public sector. So it's like part of this is why the demand to defund the police comes out so clearly, right? Because people are saying, oh, the government is saying we must share the pain. Well, what about the people literally sharing pain upon Black people? What about their salaries? What about their benefits and pensions? Why must they exist in such a bloated level for people who go to work and have a job less dangerous than, say, a roofer, when on TV, day by day, they're killing people, when a movement has started against them killing people and they continue to kill people like they did with Rayshard Brooks in Atlanta?
Yeah, yeah. So that's a perfect, lead in to one of the questions I had sent you before, because when we were on the, on the discussion the other day, you were clear and sharp about the dangers of the demands for defunding police becoming a squabble over line items in city budgets, among groups of people who are, I'm excluding the police, but in general, sort of the public sector employees, all being sort of pitted against one another. So how do we get out of this this trap? Cuffee addresses that last question in the second part of this conversation. There we get into the nitty-gritty of the defund demands specific to New York City, and also the question of social workers, whether they really can substitute for the police.